Good morning and welcome to the Ag in Uncertain Times webinar series. The presentation is intended to assist agricultural professionals, extension educators, and practitioners prepare for the challenges in developing in the agricultural industry. Today's webinar will cover regulatory environment, which including we'll have an overview of the U.S. cattle producers' outlook. We'll also look at the Food Safety Modernization Act, an update on that, as well as a kind of a midterm review of the Farm Bill and where that's going. I'm your MC for today is Trent Tickerstrom, and I'm an extension specialist at the University of Arizona, and I will serve as the host today, but I'm only able to do this through the help and assistance of many other working behind the scenes to make this presentation possible. Our team members come from a number of Western states. Without their support and support of their institutions, these webinar offerings would not be possible. Our today's speakers will be Jess Peterson, who is Executive President of U.S. Cattlemen's Association, Dr. Marissa Bunning, as an Associate Professor and Extension Specialist, Food Safety at Colorado State University, and Dr. Vin Smith, Professor, Agricultural Policy Analyst at Montana State University. Now I'll give a more in-depth formal introduction as we begin to introduce each of the speakers individually. Before we get started on that, I'll first explain to participants about the webinar where you can pose questions to the speakers. The process will follow the entry of the questions, the chat window to your lower left of your screen just below the picture. You can see over there. Once you've typed in the question, click on the button to the right to submit it, and this will convey your questions to the team in the background who would then organize the questions, and then I will feed these questions to the presenters at the appropriate time. We'd also encourage you to if you're experiencing any technical difficulties in presenting during the participation in this webinar, whether it be audio or some other issue, you may also let the crew behind the scene know about this through that same chat window. One of our team members will work to try to address the technical problems that you're facing. Finally, before we begin the first session of our conference, we would like to point out that they have a if you're having trouble viewing this screen or the text is too small, the slide materials, you may click on the full screen button to toggle slides the entire screen of the machine. As you can see the full slide up there. You can try it now if you wish. And click again. This will reveal a chat window because as you put that to full screen, the chat window will disappear. So if you want to go back there and just click on the button again and it will return you to where then you'll be able to answer the Q&A questions again. Next, we'd like to get just a better idea of who the audience is, where you come from. Kind of the first question that we're going to pose to you is just tell us about yourself, what's your primary occupation. As you can see, the list of options we have here, government agencies, agriculture producers, extension educators, banking professionals, agribusiness professionals, commodity, nonprofits. So I really appreciate this gives our speakers a chance to know kind of who the audience is, kind of where the background is, where everybody's coming from. The next question is going to be kind of what's your main place of business, and this is what we're looking for is where you're located within the United States or Pacific Island, or if you're dialing in from international, we'd like to know that too. Again, this provides some information to us about where you are, lets the speakers know kind of what kind of agriculture you might be facing in there. It's a good way to just get in touch with you. And we'll have four questions, basically, before we get started on here. So the third question is, which of the following best describes your situation? We're talking about currently produce and market agricultural products, or in the process of developing agricultural products in the market. Would you like to develop an agricultural product market or gathering information? Click on one of those again, and then we have one more final question after this, and then we will start with our formal presentations. Closing this, the final question we have, including yourself, how many individuals are participating in the website from your home or office. Again, this gives us an idea. A lot of times an individual will see one login there, but it could be multiple individuals at an office or a conference room, and so it gives us a good indication of where we're, how many people are talking with. As this is an unfunded program, so it gives us a way to really follow through with this. We're going to start with our first presenter. Our first presenter is Jess Peterson. He's the current president of the Western Sky Strategies and represents the United States Cattlemen's Association as its executive vice president. Peterson and the staff, the WSS staff, provide U.S. Cattlemen's Association full-time presence in Washington, D.C., and actually conveys the interest of the U.S. Cattlemen's Association to policymakers. Peterson also serves as a spokesperson for the U.S. Cattle Association. Frequently appears on national media forums, industry panels regarding the interest of the members, ranchers, and farmers. As a fifth-generation rancher and Montana native, Jess Peterson is familiar with the concerns of full-time ranching. For the past 7 years, Peterson has successfully represented the interests of thousands of U.S. cattle producers on Capitol Hill and inside the administration to ensure the industry maintains a competitive edge. Jess understands the needs and listens to the voice of the countryside and maintain a biweekly horn wrap conference call to facilitate the active dialogue on issues affecting U.S. cattle industry. Mr. Peterson also manages the cow-calf operation near Miles City, Montana, continually plays an active role in management of ranching operations, keeps Peterson aware of the needs and importance of American agriculture in the strong rural communities. Peterson is a proud alumnus of Miles Community College at Miles City, Montana, and Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington. Peterson also was recently recognized as one of the Cattle Business's Weekly Top 10 Industry Leaders Under 40, and is named as the Livestock Markets Digest 25 Individuals That Have Made a Difference in the American livestock industry. You know, it's also named as one of Washingtonian's magazine's 40 under 40 lobbyists. With that, I'll turn it over to Jess. And
note to self, decrease the time on my bio. Wait, we live? Hey, good morning, everyone. Jess Peterson, great to be with you. A big, big thank you to the Western Extension Committee for putting this together. And a big thank you for all the participants out there, whether you're in ag production or communications and outreach and education ag production. A big, big thank you for all that you do. Really excited to be here. We'll get started here. I want to first give you a brief overview of the issues that I'll be talking about, and then we'll dive into them a little deeper and then open it up for Q&A. So first out of the chutes, labeling, country of origin labeling, big issue, and then also a lot of you have been following this too, the GMO debate. Follow up, we'll talk a little bit about the Farm Bill, the upcoming Farm Bill and the current discussions that are underway, along with the Endangered Species Act. I think there's been some incredible victories with regards to conservation and species and habitat and mitigation measures and all the above, along with, especially going with today's theme, the cattle market trends, transparency, and trade. So we're going to talk about all that, so let's get started here. Country of origin labeling, there's a lot of slides there, and just it gives you a full chronology of everything that's happening there with regard to that law. I'm going to pull myself away from the emotion of working that law for a long time and talk just directly from some feedback, and that is, you know, it's been unique no matter how you look at the country of origin discussion, how it came under, you know, under a law with regards to the Farm Bill, Department of Agriculture, how that was written into shape, then along with the WTO and how that case played out. And I think there was a lot learned from that with regards to how lawmaking, rulemaking, and how it's implemented. So win, lose, or draw, and all that played out, you still see that process and what we learned from it. It still remains. What started country of origin labeling and where it's at today, there is an interest from the consumers to know where their food is produced. And as we see, especially spending time here in D.C. and in various urban parts of the country and travels, the consumer is always wanting to know more, not less, about their food. So from that perspective, it remains an interest from U.S. Cattlemen's and others is how do you create that definition for the product. And what happened is at the end of the year last year, obviously with the WTO tariffs looming, there was some discussion about, you know, how do we get rid of this, you know, repeal the law. So the one frame of mind was to repeal the law entirely. The other frame of mind, which the U.S. Cattlemen's and others supported, was, you know, go about it in a voluntary fashion that would be WTO compliant, but in doing so, you would allow for a prescriptive label vis-a-vis a voluntary process. So in other words, if retailers wanted that label, they could. There was a definition set forth in a statute for to do that. What we instead saw was just a blanket repeal. And so now what happens, and you'll see this reference here on December 21st, it goes back to now FSIS is in charge of what small role they've had in it previously, which was a lot of more tied to food safety and imports. So what you have right now is a little bit of confusion is, well, is FSIS going to provide those definitions? Congress didn't do that. AMS, Agriculture Marketing Service, is completely out of the equation. So as you walk into a grocery store now, and again, I'll use the example here in the nation's capital, some of them you'll see the placard above the meat counter, but on there's no labels, or the labels are gone on the actual product. Other places you can walk in and see the labeling like the cool law has never been repealed. Well, which is it? Are those labels on there accurate? And where do you work from? So from our perspective, and you see all the headlines, well, there's a lack of information. So regardless of where you're at on the country of origin labeling debate, and I want to make another quick point, too, what we learned from it. A lot of folks said, oh, we came close to a trade war and this, that, and the other thing. You know, anytime you look at these WTO cases, we're always going back and forth in negotiation. And quite honestly, it was a pretty hearty, healthy debate. We spent a lot of time talking to the Canadians throughout the process. I think folks might have played it up a little bit more. There's always a back and forth in these trade agreements. I mean, that's a big part of what they are. So, you know, obviously didn't want to have tariffs come into place, but certainly there was always a plan to work out to get a successful outcome there. And so now where we're at, though, is there is this confusion in the marketplace. And as we know, consumers will consistently ask for information on their product. Look no further than the GMO debate. And no doubt if you were to talk to the folks involved in the GMO debate and ask them to rewind 10 years, would they look to be proactive in how they were addressing this GMO information outreach to the consumers? And no doubt any one of them would say, yeah, we probably should have taken a slightly more proactive approach. So fast forward, current setting, you have the states putting forth some very strenuous, quite frankly, outrageous concepts for how labeling would move forward. I shouldn't say outrageous, but more unworkable. So you have a very unworkable, difficult lineup in which, you know, from a general perspective, it's really hard to meet those specs. However, now the fact that there isn't, they've been having discussions, they have not been able to pass a uniform labeling law from a GMO perspective. You see the folks that say, we have it in the states, and they've put pressure on Stabenow and the Democrats to say, well, if we have it in the states, we better get something that supersedes it. If this national law is going to supersede what we want, what we have, we better get a lot out of it. And there you see the ranking member of the Ag Committee, Senator Stabenow, in her comments. On the flip side, you see Chairman of the Ag Committee, Pat Roberts, say, look, this is unworkable. It's, you know, it's states dictating every state across the region, across the board, as to what's going to happen. So so from this perspective, you're seeing this thing play out. I don't have a crystal ball. This is not my wheelhouse directly with regards to GMO labeling. The only reason I use it as a reference is to compare the fact that you have, you know, consumers are wanting to seek this information, and how do we, the industry, go about informing them, and what policies do we put together, and how do we, you know, we agree to disagree. That's always going to be the spirit of what we work on here in the nation's capital on policy, but how can we, at the end of the day, work through some of these disagreements to make sure that production agriculture is getting a win. So, you know, keep you posted on that, and keep looking at this country of origin labeling. There is a question mark there that needs to be addressed, and certainly as this plays out with on the GMO labeling front will be unique for all your folks and when you talk about managing in uncertain times. One of the things that we've talked about, and I'll reference this a little bit, and that is, you know, it's an election year, it's an election cycle. So no surprise, you get a lot of angry rhetoric against Washington and all the above. And I want to talk just a little bit about a very positive piece, and that's conservation as it links to the Farm Bill. So first off, just talk a little bit about this upcoming Farm Bill, building off the current successes. I'm going to just pull a couple of these out here. Some of them are tied to U.S. cattlemen's priority issues. Others are tied to some stuff that I really think, if since we have this great group here, we need to keep talking about these. And I can tell you they're a unique success story, and we need to build on these successes. So I really want to make sure I emphasize that. Conservation, you all know these programs. A lot of you are helping making them a success story, so I thank you for that. We were just meeting with Chief Weller last week and walking through some of this and how we can build on it. The CSP, the EQIP, the RCPP, these have been extremely positive for livestock production, the environment and wildlife habitat, and especially, and I'll get into this a little bit, in this threatened and endangered species. Crop insurance, there were some debates on, you know, there's always this discussion of cuts on crop insurance. The last Farm Bill saw a linkage of conservation compliance in crop insurance. There was some kickback on that, and I understand folks in the countryside and their frustration, but what I would respond with is that, you know, by linking conservation compliance to crop insurance, there was an ally built within agriculture, which was the environmental community and conservation groups. And as you continue to battle, or we in agriculture battle for another Farm Bill, it's good to get a bigger tent for agriculture. So look at that as a success story, too, that when push came to shove, we needed another ally to move this Farm Bill forward. I'll give, and this is, you know, I'm a Montana cowboy, I'll give the environmental community, along with the hook and bullet, your sportsmen and anglers, I'll give them a credit for delivering on their promise, saying, hey, if you make these changes, we'll back your play. And so, again, just keep that in mind as these discussions on crop insurance and ties to conservation compliance and discussions for the upcoming Farm Bill. Livestock title, that was in the 2008. Cool was not, yeah, it wasn't, so I won't get ahead of myself. It was in the 2008 Farm Bill, was not in the last Farm Bill. From U.S. cattlemen's perspective, we will be talking about an upcoming livestock title. Again, real quick, touching back on the success, I'll go to the right side of the slide here, producer-driven partnerships, the Sage-Grouse Initiative. You look at, if you were to turn on the debates, you'd think that just everything is broken in Washington. Well, I'm not at all going to be the one that's going to defend Washington at all, but I will say the private-public partnerships that have been put together by both parties on both sides, so both sides of the aisle, by your producer groups, by your environmental folks, your conservation folks, all came together. And when, you know, the phrase, what's good for the bird is good for the herd. I mean, we heard that from the conservation environmental community, and we didn't know how hard they'd come to play in that and defend the efforts, defend the conservation. You all know the programs that ranchers stepped up and did. And I got to tell you, it was incredible the last 2 years to ward off this listing for the sage grouse. It was absolutely incredible to see that community say, no, I appreciate what ranchers are doing. We're standing with them. And it made a big difference. It made a big difference. I won't use the phrase, it made a huge difference. We don't need to go there, but it made a big difference with regards to that. So, again, I think we need to build on that. Anytime you look at the paper, your ag news, you can see the Northwest, there's another set of listings. Now there's discussions on the Monarch, the President's Bee Initiative, so the pollinator discussion. We need to consistently look at that in the ag community. How can we show, whether it's row crop farming, any version of livestock production, what are we doing to enhance the wildlife mitigation, endangered species mitigation efforts, habitat restoration and mitigation, and so all the above, but really looking at it, and I want to put an emphasis on that. I don't think we've talked enough about that success story, and so I'm really, really pleased and proud of what we have there, and we need to build on that in the upcoming Farm Bill. Moving over to the markets, and that actually is Leo McDonald there in the middle, along with a group of respected folks tied to the cattle industry, along with a group of our folks in front of the Capitol here a few years back. And Leo McDonald testified this past year, last July, regarding the country of origin labeling. So I have Leo there, but then below I have a quote that we use a lot around here, the U.S. Cattlemen's, and I think anyone involved in cattle production, certainly with regards to the theme of what we're talking about here today, a great phrase, markets operate best with informed and active participants. markets operate best with informed and active participants. You just can't say that enough. And so we look at the fact, historically, where we're at with our cattle prices. You see, you know, obviously a pretty big dip that took place here from March of 2015 to this past March of 2016. So no doubt a little bit of volatility out there. What does that mean? From our perspective, we believe, we're not here to point fingers at anyone, we just believe that first off you need to have a modernized set of rules that you're working with, whether it's Packers and Stockyards Act, price reporting, and what are we doing with the data? The data that we're gathering, is it the most useful? So a few steps here. Changes in CME trading. We spent a lot of time, folks probably saw this, the discussions with CME. Did they have a role? Could they help or hurt what was going on with the market crash? I mean, you can call it whatever, but the numbers that, as we saw the market drop last year, last fall. And so we've had good discussions with CME. I think that those discussions need to continue. They made some changes. They shortened up the trading window. We've heard some good reports on that. They have committed to ensuring price discovery. That's a big part of their business model. So, you know, it remains to be seen how this plays out and CME's role, but I do want to commend them. They have been very active in their response, meeting with folks, interacting certainly with us and our leadership and others across the country. So I think it's something we need to keep building and working on. With regards to the data that's out there, we see a lot of non-negotiated cattle trading. So what does that mean for market pressures? What does that mean for your producers and your communities that are you know, really getting squeezed on? You know, we think that price reporting law should have been modernized. We think the data that was being collected wasn't as accurate that it could have been, and there were some proposals we had in place. We were teed up. There was some opposition, so we couldn't move them forward. But what came out of that was a study that's being conducted by Dr. Joe Parcell and Dr. Glenn Tonser out of Missouri and K-State, respectively. And so they're looking at, they're analyzing this price reporting law, and they're going out in the countryside, and they're talking to producer stakeholder groups. If any of you have an interest in talking to these two individuals, please let me know. And what they'll do is they'll analyze their reports and say, look, this data and the price reporting law, again, we're big supporters. I think the law is a great thing. We just think it needs to be modernized to reflect what's actually happening in the marketplace with a look more like a dashboard versus a rearview mirror. It is our goal. So, again, we'll work on that, whether it's the upcoming. We'll use that information, look at the upcoming livestock title, or excuse me, reauthorization in 26 through 2020, so 5 years from now. And then as we look at this study and look at this data, we'll also have discussions about the Packers and Stockyards Act. You all know the proposed GPSA rule, clarifications and changes to the Packers and Stockyards Act came out of 2008, a lot of pushback from Congress. And so now you fast forward to whatever came, you know, the proposed rules that came out of there, largely in part, they're looking at still coming up with some stuff out of GPSA, possibly under the last remaining months in the Obama administration, but more than likely, in order to modernize or create definitions within Packers and Stockyards Act, you would need to go through a livestock title. Those discussions are taking place, and again, reflecting of the current market, how do we manage this uncertainty, and we always say by being an informed both policy participant and market participant. It's just markets work better in that regard. This slide here and this talking point has been of a bit of interest to me. Again, as we talk about politics and we talk about the current election cycle, so I want to just touch on briefly here trade to be or not to be, and so you have Japan. You have the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You have the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. We go by the acronym so much we can't even say them slower. But so TPP and TTIP. Certainly TPP, you have the opportunity to access to Japan, but also from a cattle producer's perspective, you have New Zealand right there, sending quite a bit of exports. We think they might be tapped out given the fact they're an island, but regardless, so both sides of the debate as far as where the support is for TPP, and then, of course, the opportunity for TTIP, a lot of pressures on being able to change European Union's pushback on GMOs, on antibiotics, and all the above, so better access possibly to EU and all the above. But just so those are currently, the TPP is currently under debate right now, up for consideration, and then TTIP's in the negotiation phase. one of the things that's been just interesting is, you know, no surprise, you see Bernie Sanders rising up through the ranks, teaming up with labor and all the above to come down very, very hard on these FTAs. What's been really interesting to watch is Trump and the rhetoric he's using to slam on these free trade agreements. What you'll see is a dynamic now of House members in the Republican side and in the Senate that historically supported these trade agreements. That's kind of getting whittled away by Trump's message and rhetoric. So look to see how that plays out in the entire trade arena. We don't have enough time to go into all the details there, but certainly, that's why I say trade to be or not to be, you know that in certain producer crowds in the ag community, some are highly supportive and some aren't. But now you up the ante where you have really large rallies of Sanders and Trump folks railing against trade. It really changes the tone and tenor. So look to see that in the uncertain times. And then again, just a few slides there that we'll click through. And just respect to time, I'll kind of push through here to the end. And again, encourage you all to stay connected. We have our Facebook page, our Twitter page. And then we do a biweekly horn wrap call. It's a free conference call. Just dial in there, first and third Tuesday of the month. And there's the call-in information. And again, all this information will be available at a later time. So with that, I'll take any questions, or we can move on to the next panelist.
All right, Jess, thanks very much for that real good presentation with a good overview of what's going on. We have time for about one question, and then we'll move on to our next presenter here. So the first question is, considering the 2015 price crash in feeder cattle, they were all calls for congressional inquiry. What's the status of the call for investigation?
So what's the status of the call for investigation? I'm surprised that it's the folks that teed that up, that asked for that investigation, because they made it sound like it was inevitable that it was going to happen. At this time, it's my knowledge, it's not happening. We have been constantly informing Congress about the need to address some of these marketplace mechanisms, these rules and regulations. I don't say regulations, but clarifications in the marketplace. So what we're doing, in fact, I was a little late getting ready for this webinar. We're getting called up to go, you know, speak to members of Congress next week to talk a little bit about what is that role. So the answer to that question is, there isn't necessarily a congressional investigation. There's an ongoing dialogue, and I'll say it here, it could lead to a hearing. But I want to make it very clear, we think that some of these definitions and modernizing some of the current rules and regulations would go a lot further to address where we're at right now. And we think that utilizing this possible, you know, meetings on the Hill and a possible hearing could help put clarity on that. But we want to be really careful about, you know, causing alarm without saying, here's the response for moving forward and a successful plan for moving forward.
All right, thank you. Now we'll move on to the next question, and Jess will be on later on in the panel. So now we're moving to Dr. Marissa Bunny, and she is a food safety extension specialist who currently teaches courses in food safety and has recently helped develop and implement a new course, Science of Food Fermentation. One of her research interests is centered on investigating connections between process of fermentation and the impact on safety of food and beverage products, including reducing the risk of foodborne illnesses and improving health. Dr. Bunning's outreach focuses involves development and dissemination of research-based materials and extends from local industries and agricultural producers to consumers. Dr. Bunning?
Good morning, everyone, and thanks. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk with you today about the Western Regional Food Safety Training Center. Four regional food trade safety training centers have been announced over the past 7 months. These centers came into existence because of the passing of the Food Safety Modernization Act in 2011. And I also wanted a chance to explain that my role with the centers is just volunteer coordinator of the Mountain Subregion. The title slide listed me as a director, but I don't have the power to direct anything. I'm just an extension educator trying to learn about these trainings and helping to coordinate in our subregion. So unfortunately, over the past two decades, progress in reducing the risk of foodborne illness in the United States has been limited. There have continued to be many outbreaks, often high-profile ones, associated with specific food products. Microbial testing and identification methods have improved, however, and this information is often used to trace contamination back to a specific source. Almost half of all outbreaks with a known source have been associated with fresh produce. You're probably aware of most of the outbreaks that are listed in the third bullet: ice cream, cucumbers just last year, raw poultry the year before that, eggs in 2010, spinach, to name a few. Of the ones listed here, two of them, cantaloupe, which occurred in our state, Colorado, and peanut butter, resulted in criminal charges against the growers or processors. This certainly highlights the importance of preventing contamination and the major changes that have occurred in our food regulatory system. We tend to hear about the large outbreaks that extend to more than one state, but actually, those only account for about 3% of all known outbreaks. The vast majority of outbreaks, about 97%, occur within a single state. In an effort to improve the safety of our food supply, the development of proposed food safety regulations took place over several years, leading up to the passing of the Food Safety Modernization Act, known as FSMA, early in 2011. This was the most significant reform of food safety regulations since the 1930s. One of the main goals is to put effort into prevention rather than detection and reaction. In other words, to apply interventions upstream in the food supply chain, because once a food is contaminated, it can be difficult, if not impossible, to remove that contamination. This is an extensive act, and there are seven major rules associated with it. The regional centers over the next 3 years will be primarily focused on training for produce safety and the preventive controls for human food. Information is available from FDA and other agencies to help in understanding FSMA requirements for different types and sizes of food operations. There are publications and recorded webinars that are available now that cover specific areas of the final rules. I have near me here on my desk FDA's seven-pager called Final Rule on Produce Safety and the Produce Safety Alliance's two-pager. These really help in understanding the various sections of the different rules. And kind of a disclaimer, I'm more familiar with the produce safety training. I'm working on coming up to speed and will be attending some preventive control training soon. And then hopefully we'll be much more familiar with that one. So the official name of the center in our part of the country is the Western Training Education Extension Outreach and Technical Assistance Center to Enhance Food Safety. That's quite long and ambitious, so it's often shortened to just Western Regional Food Safety Training Center, or even just Western Training Center. Our center is anchored at Oregon State University, and it includes all 13 Western states. The National Institute of Food and Agriculture and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration provided funding to establish these centers and to assist in initiating the training process within all states in our region. I thought it might be helpful to think about the time frame that's associated with FSMA. It was necessarily a slow and methodical process. Stakeholders were given opportunities to comment on proposed sections of the various rules, and numerous meetings were held to enhance communication between FDA, the food producers, and consumers. So several years passed before final rules were announced. The preventive controls for human and animal foods passed last August, and then the produce rule was announced in November. Early in 2015, opportunities were made available to establish the regional centers, and then the selection of the Western Center was announced last October. Now that the rules are finalized, training curricula to learn about the rules have been developed. And I show that on this slide as a balloon because it's still taking shape as everyone learns more about this process and the implementation of training. FDA and USDA collaborated in building the framework that's associated with FSMA. Over the past several years, then, various alliances were funded and tasked with developing curricula and preparing for the training. In the white boxes on this slide, you see Produce Safety Alliance, or PSA, which is centered at Cornell University, and the Food Safety Preventive Controls Alliance, or FSPCA, which is at the Illinois Institute of Technology. Acronyms seem to be inherent with FSMA. I keep a glossary of terms and acronyms handy and find that to be really helpful. The regional centers will be focused on training PSA and FSPCA trainers. The timeline for curricula development parallels the timeline from the previous slide. And so development of the training materials was occurring as the final rules were being completed. So this map shows the location of the four regional centers. So from left to right, we have the Western Center at Oregon State, the North Central Center at Iowa State, the Southern Center at the University of Florida, and the Northeast Center at the University of Vermont. The Western region is highlighted in blue, and as you can see, it encompasses a large percentage of the U.S. landmass and a significant amount of food production, from deserts to tropical environments, from sea level to over a mile high. Altogether, our region is a very diverse area with an array of crops and growing environments. There was a short turnaround time for the development of a proposed center, but all 13 states and two territories collaborated on the western one. It makes sense to group our large region into smaller subregions, and land grants have a long history of outreach education and established statewide networks, so it makes sense that land grants are associated with this center. The establishment of centers includes training targeted specifically to smaller operations, socially disadvantaged farmers, and small processors. Although there are exemptions available for smaller operations, many of the smaller operations will likely want to attend the trainings, they'll be interested in the trainings, and then buyers may require that operations have fulfilled the requirement for trainings, even if that operation is exempt. So, the four people listed in bold on this slide had previous experience with food safety training and produce safety. I also like to say they just happened to answer their phone early last spring. But more collaborators are definitely needed, and we're currently seeking participants and would be really appreciative if you were interested or if you know others who would be good candidates for becoming trainers or even just attending the trainings. And finally, this slide highlights the Mountain States subregion in blue. You can see that we take up a significant amount of landmass just in our subregion. We were able to arrange two of the first Produce Safety Alliance trainings that will be offered, one in New Mexico, October 17th and 18th, and then one in Denver, Colorado on October 19th and should be 20th. And then more trainings will be coming. Our aim is to hold trainings in various parts of our subregion to make these trainings as accessible as possible. There will be slots available specifically in the Denver, Colorado one for potential trainers who are interested in attending from the other states in our subregion. Now this table shows the states and territories that are broken down into the four different subregions of the West. We've got the Pacific, the Northwest, the Southwest, and then our section that includes Colorado, Montana, and Wyoming, which is known as the Mountain States. During the development of our center proposal, requests were included for what are called add-ons to the set curriculum. And these were added on to address some of the specific challenges faced in our region. For example, we have definitely have issues with wildlife, with remote production locations, with crops near livestock production, and then we have climate challenges. A few crops that are grown in our region are listed, but of course there are many more. There will be opportunities for all states to participate in developing some of these add-on trainings. So start thinking about some possible ideas of things that might be useful in your region that would apply to food safety that would be helpful for any type of food producer. Also on this slide, the goal for the number of trainers is given. And there are differences between certified trainers and lead trainers. And these types of details are outlined on the Alliance website. And hopefully more information will be on our Western website specifically about this. The goal varies based on production and population. So you can see that the goal for our six states is to have 60 trained individuals. And just think of this as the number to get things started with the training. Some support comes from the states to help with this initial number, and ideally states and land grants will be, the support comes from the centers to help, and then hopefully more support will come from states and land grants. As we prepare for the first two trainings, we're hoping to build a toolkit that will help everyone be able to outline the steps for arranging a training in your location. This is all new territory in many ways, and it's similar in some regards to the rules that were developed 20 years ago for organic production. You know, now consumers are very familiar with the organic seal on food products, and growers are familiar with the standards associated with organic production. So down the road in 10 years, information about FSMA trainings will be hopefully be common knowledge, although it's all new now. And here's the final slide. This is a picture of the website Oregon State has developed and is currently posted. And this is a place that will have information about the trainings as they become available, and it will be a resource for finding various trainings, locations, and dates. And also, once the add-on curricula are developed, which is estimated to be happening not this year, but about a year down the line, and those will be shared on this website as well. Really appreciate your time, and we're learning as we go. So I probably will not be able to answer many questions, but I would be happy to try and find any answers that you need. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for a great presentation, Dr. Bunning. We do have time for just one question that came in from the audience, and I want to reemphasize to the audience that you can click in the questions over there just under the pictures in the Q&A pod and hit that little bubble over there to provide questions. They might not get answered right now at the webinar, but they would be on, then recorded and be able to be answered later. So the main question that came in from the audience is, my concern is how FSMA discourages diverse cropping by small farms because of the complex regulatory environment. Have you looked at the FSMA requirements, identified clusters of crops that are under the same regs to make it possible for small farmers to exist and thrive?
That's a good question, and I'm trying to think about ways that we could work to address that in some of the add-on curriculum that the curricula that will have an opportunity to develop. So I didn't go over very many of the specific details because there are quite a few of them. But because of the exemptions that are available, I think that many of the smaller farms and will be able to qualify for those exemptions. I mentioned some growers may want to attend the trainings anyway, but they won't fall under the same requirements for having inspections and for having to meet the training requirements. So I may not have answered that. I will. Look into it and see if I can find out more information. I'm not going to be available for the questions later because I have to go teach a class, but anything that any questions that are passed on to me, I will try to find the answers and reply back directly.
All right, thank you, and thank you very much for your excellent presentation. We're going to move now to Dr. Vince Smith. He's a professor of economics in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Economics at the Montana State University and is co-director of Montana State University's Agricultural Marketing Policy Center. He's received his PhD from North Carolina State University in 1987 and a bachelor and master's degree from the University of Manchester in 1970 and 71, respectively. Dr. Smith's current research programs examines agricultural trade, domestic policy issues, with a particular focus on agricultural insurance, agricultural science policy, domestic and world commodity markets, risk management, and the agricultural trade policy. He is author of 9 books, monographs, and published over 200 articles and book chapters on agricultural economics, agricultural policy, and other economic issues, including health economics, altruism, and science policy. His work has been recognized nationally, internationally, through multiple national awards and outstanding research and educational programs. In 2008, he became a distinguished scholar of the Western Agricultural Economics Association, and in 2011, he received the Bruce Gardner Award for outstanding contributions to economic analyst work at USDA. Currently, he's also an American Enterprise Institute visiting scholar and a co-director of the AEI's 2012 Farm Bill Agricultural Policy Initiative. Dr. Smith?
Thanks, Trent. Always good to hear from you, and thanks to everybody for organizing this program. What I'm going to talk about is the evolution and current structure and potential future of U.S. agriculture policy, and I'm going to move as swiftly as I can. So let's get rid of the introductory slide. Just an overview. Over the past 15 years, the U.S. farm lobby, in particular USDA administrators, perhaps to their shame, and Congressional Agriculture Committee members have increasingly chosen to describe what are now known as Title I and Title XI programs in the 2014 Farm Bill as risk management and farm safety net programs. While unequivocally those programs increase farm incomes and reduce participating farms' risks of going out of business, they do anything but reduce overall risk-taking by the farm sector. They do the exact opposite. They incentivize risk because they transfer the consequences of risk-taking away from the individual farm or ranch to the taxpayer. The research here is pretty unequivocal. In fact, for the most part, the impact of many of the reauthorized crop insurance programs in the 2000 Farm Bill, as I said, is the exact opposite. The increase in risk-taking by farmers that directly derives from the incentives in created by the U.S. Crop Insurance Program in some important dimensions creates some environmental degradation issues. The U.S. Agriculture Insurance Programs, both of the major new are pure crop subsidy programs, which are price loss coverage and agricultural risk coverage. These are sometimes called crop insurance programs. They're nothing like crop insurance programs. Nobody pays a premium, and payments are not tied to current production at all. But those programs raise WTO issues that are far more severe than those associated with the now-defunct direct payments program, which essentially they replaced. Similar concerns exist with respect to the new Stacks Cotton Program and the new Dairy Margin Protection Program, both of which are what are called amber box in the WTO context. What did the Farm Bill do? It terminated the Direct Payments Program, the Countercyclical Payments Program, and the ACRE programs. It ended a plethora of milk price support programs that had essentially outlived their usefulness because the support prices had dropped well below any likely persistent market prices. It ended the Sure Crop Disaster Program. It modified the Cotton Loan Rate Program and ended other cotton programs in order to make the cotton program WTO compatible. But the new Stacks program is clearly amber box. Right now, this year, sign up under that program is modest. The problem with that program is that you can opt in or opt out of it. So when it's time to sign up in a given year, if you think that the payout will be large, you'll sign up. That's an issue that has been raised by a whole number of people. And the Farm Bill refunds a suite of 4 modestly funded livestock disaster aid programs, all of which are WTO compatible because of the way they're structured. And that makes them a little bit different from most other U.S. subsidy programs. So what else did the Farm Bill do? It introduced a new set of Title I programs, price loss coverage and agricultural risk coverage, and those are subsidy programs for which only crops previously eligible for direct, countercyclical, and acre payments are eligible, with the exception of cotton, which is not eligible for those programs. A new supplemental crop insurance coverage option was introduced to allow essentially farmers to buy down their crop insurance deductibles. Sign-up for that has been extremely modest, partly because relatively few crops are covered, partly because at sign-up time for the 2015 crop year, individuals had not decided whether they were going to go into ARC or PLC. If you go into ARC, you're not eligible for that program. And there was especially, and then you have the Stacked Income Protection Plan, which is essentially a specially subsidized SCO program for cotton. It introduced a new dairy margin protection program for milk producers that has insurance aspects and is also clearly amber box because of its link to current prices. It also has the potential to involve substantial subsidies, although this year's sign-up was relatively modest. But again, you can opt in or opt out if you're a dairy producer, and in years where it looks like the program will pay off, perhaps when prices for feed are relatively high compared to prices for milk, sign-up is likely to be much larger. And there's a modified program for crops and forage not covered by the federally subsidized crop insurance program under the NAP program. It allows for some coverage buy-up instead of being a quasi-disaster aid program and may, at the very small margin, create what economists call moral hazard incentives for changes in generating changes in production practices that actually would involve more risk. But it's likely those effects are going to be very modest because the size of the program itself is very modest. Conservation, the bill legislates the continued downsizing of the Conservation Reserve Program. That may change because as prices fall for major crops, the attractiveness of the Conservation Reserve Program increases from the perspective of farm commodity groups. It continues the Conservation Stewardship Program at a relatively high level of funding, even though the program is widely viewed by economists as providing very few additional environmental benefits. You don't get much for what, or perhaps anything, given for what is being paid for in that program. That seems to be the empirical evidence. It rationalizes a range of other conservation programs, which is a good thing. It continues the EQIP program, which is a cost-share program related to capital improvements that have environmental benefits, and it continues the various conservation easement programs. But at levels of funding that imply only transfers and no real effects on green space and wildlife habitat, effectively just a very small-scale income transfer program in the end. And here's the point. The amount of money that's available is about $1 million per state per year. That would buy three farms into the easement programs, roughly roughly current levels of funding. And if you just think about what that means, say in an area in a green area surrounding, say Columbus, Ohio, three farms going in will not really have much effect on urban sprawl, and will not do much to maintain the overall statewide environment. What does the 2014 Farm Bill do? Continuing, it continues a 25-year shift in subsidies towards, quote, crop insurance and other farm safety net programs. There's a slight reduction on conservation program spending, mainly because of reductions in the Conservation Reserve Program. There's almost a complete shift away from traditional price support, loan rate, et cetera, subsidy programs because the loan rates are so low relative to any plausible set of future prices over the next 5 years. This slide just shows over the period 1996 through 2018 how spending has changed. And the yellow line here is traditional programs. And as you can see, that yellow column has virtually disappeared in 2014. Under the 2014 Farm Bill, from being the largest column, it's now almost non-existent. On the other hand, conservation spending expanded all the way through the end of 2013 under the 2008 Farm Bill. Under the 2014 Farm Bill, spending has moderated a little bit, about $500 million. And the red line is the shallow loss welfare programs, that is ARC and PLC. What has really happened is that light blue column has expanded and expanded and expanded, and that's the crop insurance program, which now CBO estimates over the four-year period of the Farm Bill would run at about $9 billion annually. So that you can see how programs have shifted. I'm going to skip this slide because we're running out of time. And I'm going to skip the discussion of why ARC and PLC will cost so much more than was estimated by the Congressional Budget Office in 2014. It's simply that they used a baseline with relatively high prices, and prices are much lower now. and I'm going to move right along through all these slides, which just provide you information on the programs and price forecasts, all the way through to policy issues for the 2019 Farm Bill. Why 2019? Because we've not had a Farm Bill at its scheduled time since 2002. The 2007 bill became 2008. The 2012 bill became 2014. And it's quite likely we'll see a Farm Bill in 2019 rather than 2018 because, as Jess Peterson pointed out earlier, 2018 is an election year for Congress. And in general, the House and Senate Agriculture Committees truly prefer to see bills passed in non-election years for a whole variety of reasons, some good, some not so good. ARC and PLC are likely to cost about 90% more than was claimed by the House and Senate Ag Committees prior to passage of the 2014 Farm Bill. That has not gone unnoticed by interest groups critical of farm spending, some of which, for example, Heritage, are very influential on the Republican side. So farm spending is likely, if there's a president elected that's a Republican and the House and Senate remain Republican, to be quite substantially under fire. Crop insurance continues to be the largest item in the budget, and especially many interest groups on the right and the left view the harvest price option revenue contract as an expensive waste of money. Farmers don't have that view because they certainly pays out very nicely for them on a net basis, but it has been identified on the right and the left as essentially simply a heavily subsidized core program. And the administration over the last several years has argued that the harvest price option should no longer be subsidized. And that has resonated at least in some places in Congress. The ARC-PLC choice has been widely viewed as overcomplicated by many farmers, and the structure of the program may be revisited simply because many farmers have said the program's too complicated. Conservation programs may also be revisited. For example, if commodity prices remain at current or more moderate levels, as I said earlier, then farm groups may well push for an expansion of the Conservation Reserve Program. That money might well come out of the Conservation Stewardship Program, which beyond the farm sector is being criticized as essentially a subsidy program targeted especially to states like Iowa. The original proposer of that project was from Iowa, a congressman from Iowa. And the program was pushed heavily by the hog industry, by the way. So you could see a reallocation of funds between those two programs. And with that, I'm going to end and show you the most interesting slide, which is of the Gallatin River and people floating down that risking life and limb. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for a great presentation, Dr. Smith. So we have a couple questions came in to you, and then we'll move to the panel. And I know Dr. Bunning had to leave the class, so it will be a panel with you and Jess. So a couple questions that came in for Vince is, what are some of the key points of discussion and moving into the next Farm Bill, and what do you think will change, and what do you think will stay the same?
Budget will always be an issue, so the baseline, what's called the baseline, will be the initial focus of discussion. Now, the baseline for the Farm Bill is close to $100 billion a year, of which the majority is allocated for nutrition programs. Seems unlikely that the nutrition programs will be the subject of any debate. The Republican Party's fingers were heavily burnt as a result of the push to separate nutrition out from the Farm Bill. Now, whether or not that's a good thing is a different matter, but nutrition is probably off the table in terms of cuts in spending for a whole bunch of reasons. The other issue, though, comes back to spending under ARC and PLC. And the rhetoric is going to be as follows. Those programs were put in to replace direct payments. Direct payments was roughly $5 billion a year. The claim was these programs will cost roughly $2 billion or more less. Now it looks like they're going to cost $1.5 billion more than the direct payments program. And so fiscal hawks are going to very sharply address that program. There's also going to be a debate about the value of crop insurance programs, whether or not they should stay as structured. The evidence really is pretty clear that they've encouraged the expansion of production into environmentally fragile lands. So this is going to be a difficult issue for the coalition of the environmental groups and the farm groups, because that program puts them in direct conflict, and increasingly the environmental groups are aware of that.
All right, thank you very much for the good answer and the presentation. We're going to move now to the panel questions. And within that, Jeff, are you on?
I'm here.
Okay. So, or since we're running short on time, we'll ask one or two questions apiece, and then we can continue on with a couple of the final wrap-ups. There will be some polling questions that come up. So the first one here is for Jess. Is that while COOL has been repealed for meat, is it still in force for fruits? If so, why does it work for fruits and not meat? What role did Packer brand fit into the COOL debate?
So great question. It is still in place for fruits. And one of the things that came out of it is you did have, you know, packers and importers didn't like the law. Canadian-Mexican countries didn't like the law. Typically, from their viewpoint, it was how it was implemented, how it was written from a mandatory standpoint in the definition. So so it works for fruits. We think it should work for all products to be able to inform the consumers. And I'm not too sure about the packers and how they played a role in that, you know, that question. Certainly they had an interest in how that law would play out, but they also, with their packer labels and whatnot, and there's a lot of promotion around branded labels and branded products, which we think is a good thing, over 100 of them. But again, at the end of the day, there should be a basic information from where that country is, where that product is from.
All right. This question is for Vince. What has been the reception to the shift towards a more crop insurance-like program?
Well, the farm sector has played the following card. They have said, we know direct payments were politically toxic, and they were. The super committee in 2011, in charge of making substantial adjustments to the federal budget, in private told the farm lobby that either they gave up direct payments, or total cuts that had to come forward on farm spending would be equal to $5 billion, not about the $1 billion or less that they were subsequently required to offer. So essentially, a variety of commodity groups came up with the idea, let's argue that we should only have help when we need it. And that's how the corn growers dreamt up the ARC program, and how the peanut and rice and some other peanut growers argued for price loss coverage. And so that was the generation of the two new straight subsidy programs, which are so often described as risk management programs and insurance programs, which are not. Now, the other move has been occurred through the Agricultural Risk Protection Act to very importantly extend subsidies to the harvest price option contract, which is now the contract of choice for those for growers of those commodities for which the contract is available. So that's corn, wheat, and so on. So that contract is available for something like 80% of the book of business that RMA has. Now, that action was not a farm bill action. That was ARPA was an independent of the farm bill process initiative, although all of the ARPA provisions pretty much are now wrapped into and have become part of the 2014 farm bill.
All right. Thank you. And one another question here for Jeff. And there has been a few events concerning federal grazing lands, i.e. the recent event in Nevada and Oregon. Is there any congressional inquiries or hearings affecting federal grazing?
Sue, there's been a bit of interest on that, and I don't have that information handy. I know the House and some of the subcommittees have spent some time reviewing that. And then there's been several letters of inquiries and then direct members talking with the agencies and whatnot. So, again, I can't speak to exactly other hearings. I don't have that familiar information with me. But what I'll say in kind of a greater context is we need to have that dialogue needs to be continued with the agencies that manage those lands, with the folks, the livestock producers, and Congress. So I think this past few years has shown there needs to be more discussions. And what I'll always say, and we go back to, which is why I'm bullish on these conservation programs and things we've pulled together, and we show the good acts of players involved, and even kind of show a little bit more of what from both sides what's needed to make it all work out. So that's where we're at on that.
All right, thanks. One last question, then we're going to move on, and this is to Vince. And this is, there have been some news reports of reducing the crop insurance payments made to agents. What is the status of this, and do you think it's a workable change?
Well, two comments. I think what's being talked about is the proposal to reduce by $300 million a year payments to the insurance industry through the insurance companies that was in the early November Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act, the Bipartisan Budget Act. That $300 million would probably mainly have come out of compensation to agents. But as Eric Belasco and I pointed out at the time, agents are selling the same number of policies and covering roughly the same level of acreages as they were in 2005 when, in inflation-adjusted terms, they were willing to do, the industry was willing for them to do that work with roughly $1 billion to $1.25 billion less for the total sector. Almost surely taking $300 million out of the $2.7 billion the industry is currently getting to deliver $6 billion of subsidy. So that's roughly 40 cents per dollar going to the farmers. Taking $300 million out of that would have absolutely zero impact on the availability of crop insurance to the farmers. Compensation for agents would drop. Some agents would leave the business. The expansion in agent numbers has been so substantial over the last 10 years. We have more agents running around chasing farmers now than you would believe. It's sort of like the old story. The USDA has 100,000 employees, and that's one employee for every two major producers of agricultural commodities of the 200,000 farms that produce roughly 70% of total output. We're not quite at that point, but we seem to be getting to that point with insurance agents because the business has been so lucrative over the last 9 or 10 years. There's a very interesting paper on this, readily accessible to anyone, that came out through the Environmental Working Group by Bruce Babcock at Iowa State.
All right, thank you very much. And
You're welcome.
I would like to thank all of the presenters and all the great presentations that they had. We'll move on now to, as I mentioned prior, this has been a series of workshops or webinars going on. And as you can see, the next ones we're going to have is May 5th. We're going to be talking about local foods. And then on May 10th, we're going to be talking about the state of the ag economy. So I look mark your calendars for those two events, and we hope you join us for those. We also look at like to hear from you about the topics and presentations you would like to see offered in the future besides the ones that I just mentioned. You can either send us an inquiry in the chat pad over on the left-hand part of the screen, as we mentioned before, or you can send an email directly to information@farmmanagement.org, and we will receive that question and your comments there as well. You can receive more information, as we mentioned earlier, recordings, other information is available at the Ag Uncertain Times website, which will provide additional instructions on how to access in just a minute. If you're interested in copies of today's presentation, they are also available to download, as well as we've done over 100 of these webinars and presentations since we started this in 2009, and all those are recording and available for download for your use. So the file sharing, what we provide now is there's been a number of references listed and mentioned in today's presentations, along with email addresses throughout the webinar, in order to provide a single point of reference for all the information. We have compiled this and a PDF, which is made to download in your pod right now. So you just simply click on that and hit the Save to My Computer, and it will download that for you. Let me again close by extending our thanks to these speakers, the first-class presentations on the U.S. cattle producers in 2016, the Food Safety Modernization Act and update, and then the 2014 Farm Bill a midterm review. I would also again like to thank all your participants today in today's webinar conference, and we sincerely hope to find you at the next one, as we mentioned earlier. Hope to see you again in one of the upcoming presentations. Until then, we offer sincerest hopes of success and meeting the challenges of today's and uncertain times. And for that, again, Certain Times team, I'm Trent Tiggerstrom, and for everybody in behind the scenes, again, we thank you for your participation in this. Thanks.